Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It gets embarrassing when the applause you get before you speak are longer than the applause you get after you speak. Sounds like I've used that line before, I know. But the corporate war against democracy. Well, through much of history, state leaders have been concerned with two things. The first is to extract surplus value from the labor of the people. That is to extract wealth created from the land and the labor of the many into the coffers of the few. It's called the surplus value, the value that labor creates, that labor itself does not consume to sustain itself. That's been the goal through most of class history. That's the goal of the feudal lords. That was the goal of the ancient slaveholders. That was the goal of the capitalists. That's their goal today, to keep that to extract as much wealth as they can. This is what the monarchs of Europe did. A.L. Morton, in his book, A People's History of England, written many years ago, he just mentioned it as a throwaway line. He said, well, why are all these monarchs always out there, you know, grabbing more land, grabbing more people to work the land, monopolizing trade, finding new ways to tax the people? Generally, the goal, the function, the purpose of these monarchs and rulers and princes and kings and queens, the function, their intent is to extract that surplus, to get wealth for themselves so that they can go on living in the style to which they're accustomed. The more I can get you to produce, and the less I can get you to consume, the more there will be for me. I mean, in terms of sustenance. The more I can get you to work for me, and the less you work for yourself, as with the corvée, you know, in medieval France, the peasants hated it. They couldn't harvest their own crops. They had to go harvest the Lord's crops. They had to go work for him and couldn't get their own work done. The more I can get that arranged, the more there will be for me. Now, democracy is the antithesis of that process. Democracy is a reaction. It is historically a popular reaction to that historic system of expropriation. There are two definitions of democracy. I use both of them. I'm saying democracy is defined in these two dimensions. The first is procedural democracy, or what we would call political democracy. A set of procedures, elections, free speech, limited terms, legal strictures, majority rule, minority rights, etc. That definition of democracy has no social and economic content. It just sets out what are the rules of the game. Does someone have a Kleenex, please? If you have, come volunteer it. Preferably unused, okay? Great, thanks. The other dimension of democracy. The other dimension of democracy is substantive democracy, is the substance, or what I call economic democracy. That is, democracy's got to be more than just the rules for a game. Democracy, defined only in its procedures, is certainly reduced to a game. But democracy, the whole function of it, the whole historical meaning behind it, the whole reason it emerged in Athens and in the Indian republics back in the Middle Ages and in ancient Rome and in various other places, the whole reason for its emergence was for substantive outputs. Not only rule by the people, but rule for the people. The interests of the demos must get primary consideration. A system that observes regular elections, but these elections prove insufficient to control and direct rulers towards serving popular interests and democratic needs, then that system is not all that democratic. What use if a population has the vote and is forced into starvation, as is happening in a number of third world countries where the U.S. has put up showcase democracies that are pursuing reforms, as is happening in places like Nicaragua? That is, you keep the highly inequitable and exploitative maldistribution of wealth. You keep that high, big gap between wealth and poverty, between the few and the many. You keep that whole social structure untouched, but you have this showcase front, the superstructure of procedural democracy. Then democracy doesn't become a weapon for the people; it becomes a kind of gloss. A mask for an undemocratic social structure. Democracy is a wonderful invention by the people of history to protect themselves against the abuses of wealth, against rule by the wealthy, which is known as plutocracy. That's what it was in Athens in the 5th century when the Hoplites said, "We are not going to fight." The Hoplites had enough land, they had enough little bit of money to be able to buy their own armor and swords. They were the infantry. They were not the officer class, which would be the aristocracy. We are not going to fight unless you give us the vote. And with the vote, then we can have a say as to who pays the expenses of government and civil life and the polity. And that was the beginning under Cleisthenes' leadership, and later under the greatest democratic leader that Athens ever produced, who was Cleisthenes' young lieutenant, came from an aristocratic family, but a militant believer in democracy. His name was Pericles. So that's the way these things emerge. The democratic struggle is closely linked to the class struggle. Now, you don't have to go back to the 5th century Greece to see that same thing happening. In our own lives, or in the lives of our parents, grandparents, we've seen all sorts of social groups fight for the right to a franchise because they were in pursuit of substantive things. When women 180 years ago first started agitating for the vote, it wasn't out of some gender ego, oh, you men have the vote, so we should have the vote. There were very real, substantive grievances that they had about the conditions of their lives, about protections from male abuse, about access to education, about the right to own property, about the right to get an advanced education. These were all very real struggles, and they still are in some instances. And so it is with a lot of things. The people seek participation because of their substantive, their real material needs. And the pursuit of substantive democracy brings an expansion of procedural democracy. And likewise, the strengthening of procedural democracy helps in the pursuit of economic gains. And that was true also of American workers in the 1820s and 30s. The American workers wanted a decent wage. They couldn't get a decent wage. They tried to form combinations, or what we would today call labor unions. The combinations were ruled by the courts and the laws as illegal. Violation of, I forget, what were the pegs? They put them on due process and various other things. Well, they realized if they were going to get better wages, they needed more organization and clout. They had to be able to strike, withhold their labor. To do that, they really needed organization. To get that organization, they needed to change those laws. To change those laws, they needed to be able to vote. So there they were fighting for the right to vote. To fight for the right to vote, they had to agitate for the right to assemble. That, too, was considered illegal. To even assemble, to agitate, to get the vote. So there were these fights over the rules of the games, and many political fights are fights over how the rules of the games, how the rules are going to be set down, because that predetermines the outcome. Now, there's a rough but very real correlation between the conditions of labor, the standard of living, and the viability of democracy. Countries like Denmark and Sweden that have strong labor movements also have better services, better human services, better education, health care, better wages, both individual wage and the social wage. By social wage, I mean the whole condition of the community and the set of services and the like. And they also have viable democratic politics and individual rights. Far from perfect, I'm not putting up these social democracies as utopias or the final models at all, but better than most other places. In countries like capitalist Indonesia and capitalist Turkey and capitalist Nicaragua, capitalist Nigeria, it's just the opposite. Labor unions are almost non-existent. The social wage is almost non-existent. Living standards are low. Democracy is miserably anemic and enfeebled and actually non-existent. So there's a real correlation then here. And so with other issues in publics. Those countries where capitalism operates most successfully are the latter ones I mentioned. Capitalism is much more successful in Nigeria and Indonesia than it is in Denmark and capitalist Sweden. You see that, don't you? Much more successful. Oh, some of you are skeptical. Some of you don't understand that because you're thinking of success in terms of the well-being of the populations. But capitalism has nothing to do with the well-being of the populations. It's much more successful in Indonesia because the rate of surplus accumulation is many times higher than it is in Denmark. In Denmark, you've got stupid, ridiculous, meddling, troublesome, undermining, wasteful things like minimum wage laws, like occupational safety, like environmental protections, like pension funds, like medical care. And every dollar I have to spend on stupid things like that is one less dollar that I can put in my pocket. And the one thing about the haves that one thing in that conflict between the haves and the have-nots, you must remember that the haves are really misnamed. They are not the haves. They're the have-it-alls. They won't stop. They want to have it all. So it's not in Western Europe and Scandinavia or even North America that that capitalism works at its best. It's at its best in those countries where democracy is weakest. Not in those countries where profit margins are cut into by all these various things that I've talked about, regulations and taxes and such. So a successful society, a successful system, means something quite different to the capitalists than it does to the citizens of an aspiring, struggling democracy. Kent McDougall, very nice gentleman, was a journalist for many years. He wrote a series of articles in Monthly Review, and then he talked about how he retired from journalism. And he said, well, you know, I opposed the system, but I must say, sort of almost embarrassed about it, I was willing to take the pension that the system gave me. And I want to say, Kent, you don't have to be embarrassed about it, because that capitalist system never gave you that pension. That capitalist system never gave anyone that pension. That was taken from the teeth and the claws of those guys. They fought tooth and nail against those pensions. They fought against the minimum wage. They fought against you having a paid vacation. They fought against you having medical care that they'd have to pay for. And they're still fighting against all those things, and they're still trying to take back every one of those things. They fought against Social Security and the like. And that's what reform means for them. Reform means that all this should be rolled back. So with medical care, affordable housing, consumer protections, workplace safety, collective bargaining, a livable environment. All areas in which democratic forces have made gains, all those areas remain at risk. All those areas are in danger of being rolled back. That is their agenda. That is what George Bush is about. He's not stupid. Please stop focusing on how stupid he is because he fumbles a few words here and there and gets his sentences all wound up. Dwight Eisenhower did that. Ronald Reagan did that. And we have all our liberal intellectuals sitting there and feeling so superior. Oh, they're so stupid. And start focusing on how vicious these guys are. Not how stupid, but how vicious they are. So to the extent that we have any modicum of decent living, which doesn't extend to millions of people, even in our own obscenely prosperous society, to the extent that we even have that, to the extent we have made those gains, it's not because of capitalism, but despite it. It was not capitalism that gave you these things. It was the historic fight against capitalism. It was the historic fight, the historic democratic struggle against capitalism. Well, meanwhile, the capitalist business community, the corporate business community, crows the most about self-reliance while constantly feeding out of the public trough. Aid to families with dependent children, it reached up to about $20 billion of the federal budget. Welfare payments in this country, when Clinton came into office, were about $20 billion. Corporate welfare payments average year are about $100 to $120 billion a year, and maybe even more depending on what you want to call corporate handout or not. Tax write-offs, export supports, guaranteed loans. You know what a guaranteed loan is? It means when the company floats this big loan, gets a big loan, and they can't pay it, the taxpayers pick it up. That's what the savings and loan scandal is about. We ended up paying about $40 billion out, one of the biggest ripoffs in history. Marketing subsidies, bailouts, billions of dollars in bailouts. If you have a small business and you can't make it and you go under, you just go under. But if you're a big corporation, you get bailed out. You do, because after all, those jobs and the economy depends on it, and we have to help them out. We're doing it for the workers, you know. Research and development grants, land and mineral giveaways. The whole military industry, the armaments industries, almost all their research and development tabs are picked up by the Pentagon. Almost, not all, almost all of it. Did I say land and mineral giveaways? Infrastructure subsidies. For instance, the government builds literally tens of thousands of miles of roads into the national forest so that the timber companies can go in and strip the forest. So they get subsidized by the taxpayers. They're subsidizing everything they do. They live off us in every way. It's not only that they expropriate surplus value from the worker by giving him less than the value his labor produces, but that system of expropriation goes on. When you leave with that check, well, when you first get that check, you remember the very first check you ever got in your life? Many of you are young enough to remember it, and many of you are old enough to remember it. The older ones remember those first days even clearer sometimes. So remember that first check you ever got? You looked at it, you said, there must be some mistake. It should be for 2 weeks, and it looks like it's only 1 week. I said, no, look on the other side there. We took off for that. That goes in there so that your boss can get subsidized later on. Because your expropriation, the exploitation of you, doesn't end as a worker. It goes on as a taxpayer. It goes on as a consumer. And it goes on as a member of your community. Those are the four basic ways you're being exploited. Also, another giant hidden subsidy for big corporate America is deficit spending. That's a hidden subsidy. With deficit spending, what you're doing is you're borrowing from the people we should be taxing. We cut the taxes of the very richest, and then we don't have enough money to balance the budget. And the national debt is the accumulation of yearly deficits. So you have this upward redistribution. Then you have to turn around and tax the population to pay the interest on that national debt. So you're taxing the poor in order to give money to the rich, because you've borrowed money from them. That's why George Bush, has no interest in having a budget surplus. He wants to keep this country in debt. He wants the demos to be indebted to the aristocracy. It represents, therefore, an upward redistribution of income. Well, ladies and gentlemen, do we really want an unregulated, free market corporate capitalism? Yes or no?
No!
I was hoping for that answer. Do you want to eat food that's produced by that kind of system?
No!
Would you fly in an airplane that was run purely on free market principles in an airline? First of all, where would you land? All the airports are socialistic. What? It's shocking, isn't it? Airports are built, but United Airlines didn't build this nice new Portland airport that I just came in on. That's built by taxpayers' money. How would you land? And let's say you found a place you could land. How would you land? Would there be free market competitive landing? You know, United gets in ahead of Delta. Oh, watch this. Oh, watch this guy. I'll get ahead of him. It's bad enough some of them drive that way on the road. Do we need it up there too? Of course, you would have more choice with free market airlines. You could fly maintenance or non-maintenance. Don't criticize free market capitalism, we hear. A real free market capitalism, free of the irksome, expensive, distorting, meddling government regulations, that has never even been tried. So how can you criticize a system that's never been tried? Oh, but I must say, I really must beg to differ. It has been tried. It was called 1890. It was called 1900. In 1900, we had this free market that these people are fighting to get back to. We had mass destitution. We had no minimum wage laws. We had child labor, 10-year-olds working 14 hours a day in factories. We had typhoid epidemics. We had people, large numbers, dying of contaminated foods, even much higher numbers than today, even. We had no occupational safety or environmental protection. The opulent class paid no taxes, and they paid out starvation wages. The United States was a third world nation a half a century before the term was invented. Do you want to go back to third worldization?
No!
Okay. You can laugh, but audience participation is very important, I can find. Okay. And by the way, as was said earlier, we have to watch the labels. Free market capitalism, the free market is not free. It's not even a market, really. It has to do with investment. It doesn't do with sales, really. Free market capitalism is monopoly capitalism. Unregulated free market corporate capitalism is capitalism without democracy. And it gives us disasters. It's giving us disasters right now with the rollbacks. It's giving us public services that are falling apart. It's giving us water that isn't safe to drink. It's giving us global warming that threatens apocalyptic doom. Today's TV report, I was just sitting in my hotel room, and there it came on. This summer has been the hottest and driest. And this has been happening every single summer, record summer, hotter and drier. It's given us deforestation, drought, topsoil ruination. It's giving us genetically modified foods to extend corporate monopoly control over the points of production, food production. It's given us an airline industry on the verge of collapse. It's given us higher and higher utility and telephone bills, billions stolen by energy companies that corner markets and price gouge us, billions taken out of the pockets of us taxpayers. More and more wealth it's given us, and more poverty throughout the world. The number of people living in poverty today is growing at a faster rate than the world's population. So poverty is spreading. And finally, unregulated free market corporate investment has begun to victimize the investor class itself, along with workers and pension funds and all that. Enron, WorldCom, Adelphia, America Online, Xerox, Merrill Lynch, and all those other white-collar mafia organizations are now plundering their own investor class, which is why you read about it in the newspapers, you know, because there are some people who have stocks and such who are very unhappy about this. The financial and corporate leaders are stealing from the small and not so small investors. The goal of a corporation, and that's not some aberrant distorted offshoot of capitalism. I mean, that could be one of the, that is the inevitable and natural outcome of an unregulated capitalism, a capitalism that isn't restrained and pulled in somehow with some element of democracy. Because the goal of a corporation is not to create jobs. They'll eliminate jobs if they can create their increase their profit margin. It's not to produce goods and services. The goal is to accumulate profits. David Broderick made that point years ago when he was president of USX, formerly US Steel. He said, US Steel is not, Senator, US Steel is not in the business of making steel. It's in the business of making, and then he said the correct term, not profits. He said, it's in the business of making the highest possible profits for shareholders. And I looked, I said, oh, hey, finally. It's so like a breeze. You have to hear it from the capitalists, a moment of truth where they actually say what they actually are doing. He was reminding the senator, hey, you know, this is what we do, you see. Ford, I remember Henry Ford III appearing before the Ribicoff Committee, Senator Ribicoff of Connecticut, back when there was that thing, unsafe at any speed, and the cars were not safe and all that. And Ford said, he said, look, Senator, Ford Motor Company isn't in the business of safety. I thought that was a very good idea. Said it, truth, wonderful. You know, and Ribicoff is, you know, the cameras on, wow, can you say that? The American people will not stand for this sort of thing, you know, sort of, you know. But that's okay. That's what we want. We want them to have to force that hypocrisy. We want them to have to maintain that appearance. We want them to then have to make certain concessions to maintain that appearance. That's the way we wrench concessions out of them. That's the way. When they start acting that way and start talking about the people and this and that, you can be sure they're getting a little nervous about the people. Now, everything I have said so far flies in the face of the accepted wisdom that capitalism and democracy go hand in hand. Senator Bill Clinton, we are pursuing policies that advance the interests of free market democracy everywhere in the world. Its official rendition is really very misleading, since the owning class is involved in government to a degree as no other group. No labor, no farmers, no ordinary system, citizens. Oh, I had a glass here. One of the ways they're undermining democracy is by circumventing it, leaving you with the democratic forms, but divesting you of the substance of making the democratic decisions, as with international trade agreements, GATT, NAFTA, GATS, all of which are designed to disallow federal, state, and local governments from creating and performing public services, because these become interferences with free market. These become lost market opportunities and such. These become constrictions on property. With the overthrow of communist competitors, the corporate powers are pulling out the stops. For them, it's time to do away with labor unions, publicly funded education, public transportation, public medical services, and all those other socialistic human services. Why should we have to do that? We don't have to buy off our working class anymore. We don't have to say to them, you see how much better you got it than those people in Russia or Yugoslavia? We don't have to do that anymore. We can go in and it's all over. And by the way, it's the same with it's not just the U.S., but that kind of rollback is being replicated. Struggles going on in Western Europe, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, with serious defeats for labor. There's rollback also throughout the Third World. There's no longer any need to build up stable, prosperous middle classes in Third World countries to keep them from going communist. There's no need anymore to protect small property owners and indigenous industries developing. Instead, now the goal is to deindustrialize them, to monopolize the land, the resources, the markets of the world. The goal is really to get back to a colonizing global system as in 1900 again. The goal of global finance corporate capitalism is the third worldization of the entire world, including this country. The major instrument that is used for this global third worldization is the United States National Security State, the CIA, the Pentagon, the military, the IMF, the World Bank, economic sanctions, and the whole financial military arsenal of what is called the West. Capital needs to continually expand. And now it must expand on a global level, even right down to ownership of the world's water supplies. You see how that's happening. They go around and they've got all this money and they've got to constantly make more money on the money. They've got to invest so they can get back more than they put in. And they go and they look at every human need. And now there are places that have water supplies where people actually get water. Water is a precious thing. People can hold back from buying fancy clothes or even cars or refrigerators or whatever, but they can't hold back on consuming water. They need water. So you go in and you try to privatize the water and you try to own it. The idea that you can have a social function here, creating jobs, there are people who work in public water systems, you know, who then pay taxes that are used to create more jobs and to keep this thing going, answering human needs, a human market here. So people have money, who have these jobs, can pay for these taxes and so forth, and you get this water. The idea that all of that could be going on, and I'm not making a penny in profit out of it, is just something that infuriates them. Marx used to say that capitalism is a very jealous system. It goes into every corner of society, every corner of the world to recreate it in its own image. So you have a nice little coffee shop and it's doing very well. Well, that's a lot of capital. You add up all the independent little coffee shops in America, that's millions of dollars. Let's start something. Let's call it, let's call it Star, what do we call it? Star Wars? No, Star, something like that. Starbucks, yeah, that's a good one, I like that. And you go in there and you take it over. And corporate capital moves all over, destroying happy communities in the Philippines, in the Amazon, in Africa, in the United States, doing it for fast buck plunder. In the Philippines, you have what are called these business zones. You go into this island. You've got literally thousands of people who've been living here for centuries. They have these beautiful groves that they've cultivated, all sorts of foods and fruits. They have a fishing industry and they fish. They do some farming. They have a minimal cash economy. You know? You go in, and now you get a phony deed from the government and all that, and you say, the land no longer belongs to you, and you drive them off. And then you wipe out and you cut down all these trees one time. It's tropical. It has very little topsoil to really speak of. You turn it into a wasteland. You destroy these people's lives. They end up crowding themselves off into the shanty towns with nothing left to do but drugs and prostitution or crime or just utter misery and be more likely being victimized by those systems. And you do that so that you can make an extra dollar in that little business zone, as it's called. A business zone. And this is called development. This is called bringing the Philippines up to modernized industrial standards and levels and all. They don't tell you. They don't tell us the whole story, do they? They really don't tell us the whole story, do they? Am I being paranoid? Do I have a conspiracy theory? Yes, I do. Conspiracy is not always a theory. In addition to the plunder and the profit, they have another goal. And that goal is control and power. That's a secondary instrumental goal. You can't get the profit and you can't get the plunder unless you have power and control and you keep that system going. Those who say that, oh, politics and history is all about power, really ought to think about it again. No, really, power is not an end in itself. Not even for the ambitious careerists, the Henry Kissingers and the Bill Clintons who would sell their firstborns to get up there or sell their souls and all that. You notice, they do that, and they're obsessive in their first intent and their burning desire is their career advancement and success, you see. That's true. But even they can only do that by serving wealth. They do that by serving wealth. Those others of us who choose a career against them, we're often called the demagogues and the power-hungry people. I remember back at University of Illinois when I used to be out there demonstrating with the students. I was a visiting associate professor, and the state troopers came one day and beat the hell out of me, busted my head open, and I was thrown in jail, sentenced to 2 years in prison. It was a suspended sentence, bloodied all over me. And people were saying, critics were saying, that Parenti is power-hungry. And I was saying, power-hungry? We are power-hungry? You're manipulating these people. So anybody who tries to do something for social justice, taking that very risky and very costly course against the powers that be, not like a Henry Kissinger or a Bill Clinton who sucks up to them and kisses and fawns them and all that and gets elevated in advance. That's a very smooth, this is competitive, of course, but they make their way up there much quicker and with much less risk. They're not called power-hungry. We're called power-hungry. Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, who's finally doing something, first time Venezuela has a president in a while, doing something for the people, is called a demagogue and power hungry. I've seen this all through history. When you read history from ancient Rome on, you know, all the populares, the leaders, the Gracchi brothers, Julius Caesar, every one of them who tried to do something for the people were immediately denounced as demagogues who pandered to the people just to elevate themselves and win prestige for themselves. And so and all of them were killed by the aristocratic class. I've just written a book about this called The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome. It'll be out in the spring. So power is really, but power, as far as systemically speaking, power is not an end in itself. It is almost always used in the service of wealth, both to protect direct investments in wealth, but also to protect that whole system of investment and control and institution and mythology and ideology and such that keeps the thing in place. Even sometimes at a cost to direct investment. For instance, the policy of the U.S. national security state toward Cuba is a case in point. That's a systemic decision at a cost to direct investments by U.S. investors. Individual corporations could go into Cuba and could have done these things. Instead, it's the Canadians and the Western Europeans who are doing it. But the goal, you see, the U.S. national security state has decided it's much more important to starve out, to beat out, to isolate this system that is an alternative system as a threat, a threatening model to the dominant paradigm that we want to make completely global. That is the rational, consistent goal of U.S. foreign policy. I am not one of those people who thinks that U.S. foreign policy is confused, it's muddled, it's not well formulated. That policy is remarkably consistent and remarkably successful in overthrowing all sorts of governments. To keep the system of capital accumulation going, to keep that system of expansion and investment going and growing, to cast the diseconomies onto the Commonwealth, the infrastructure costs, the toxic wastes and environmental destruction, and the control and suppression costs. As the only superpower in the United States now, the only superpower, the United States, can now act as an unchallenged global plutocracy, determining who shall live and who shall die. The explicit goal, and you listen to Haas, you listen to Richard Perle, Elliot Abrams, Condoleezza Rice, they're very explicit about it. They've said, our goal is to make sure that the United States remains the only superpower in the world. Well, there's something more in that. Not just the only superpower, prevent any other superpower from emerging. I think another goal is to prevent any regional powers from emerging. Regional powers can start building alliances. They can start taking independent courses. And I think another goal is to prevent any self-defining countries from arising. A country like Yugoslavia, which is what I argued in To Kill a Nation, which refused to join the European Union, which refused to join NATO, which insisted on keeping an economy that was fairly prosperous, far from perfect, but 80% of it was under public ownership, now broken up, made weak, powerless, into right-wing mini-republics and principalities. Prevent self-defining countries like Iraq. Iraq is another problem. Lots of oil, high-quality oil, a lot of it still untapped, by the way, publicly owned, lots of water. Some countries in the Middle East have oil but no water. Some have water and no oil. Iraq is the only one that has both. A substantial education, well-educated, a good agricultural base, not good anymore since most of it has been destroyed by the depleted uranium of the Gulf War of 1991. So you target Iraq for strategic reasons. You target Iraq to break it and make it weak, the same reason you targeted Yugoslavia. You keep the region powerless. You keep them poor. You keep them hungry. Because the poorer and the hungrier you are, the harder you will work for less and less. Iraq made the mistake of trying to become a self-defining country and was a potential regional power. Besides those strategic interests, there are political reasons for war against Iraq. A war against Iraq will distract from domestic problems and major scandals and the recession. A war against Iraq will justify increasing the military spending. It will fuel the patriotic hype. And when people rally around the flag, the patriotic hype means people will rally around the flag, and it happens to be a flag which is wrapped around the president. It will increase his poll ratings. It will diminish and discourage the momentum behind dissent. And it will, of course, increase pressures for control and repression of dissent. So there are strategic, global, plutocratic reasons for hitting other countries. For those who don't want to rule in a democracy, they pursue perpetual war. Perpetual war brings a siege psychology. Perpetual war brings a militaristic psychology rather than a democratic psychology. Here's something I want to read to you that I recently wrote. Many wars are begun, noted Alexander. I'm old enough now, I can quote myself, right? I've reached that age where I can sort of do that. Okay, many wars are begun, noted Alexander Hamilton in Federalist Number 6, because of the political interests of leaders. By plunging into conflicts abroad, they seek to diminish the impact of troublesome issues at home, thereby securing their political fortunes. A war against Iraq comes in the middle of a serious recession, one that President Bush is more interested in ignoring than resolving. His popularity also has been slumping badly because of the corporate scandals. Every evening, TV news programs are peeling off successive layers of corruption, thievery, bribery, and plunder in what some consider the greatest financial conspiracy in the history of the world. But once the media becomes preoccupied with selling the latest high-tech war, the domestic scandals will drop from the evening news. Now, I actually misled you deliberately. I didn't recently write this. I wrote this 10 years ago. It's in my book, Against Empire. And the Bush I'm talking about is George I. I changed a little bit of the wording. I took out savings and loan scandals and put in corporate scandals, and I deleted in July 1990 because that would have given it away. But if you read it with that light editing, it could apply. I mean, it could apply to exactly what is happening today. And they say you have correct theory when it can predict repeatable empirical phenomena. To justify these aggressions, to justify the aggressions that U.S. leaders commit abroad, they conjure up fairy tales. Fairy tales that demonize the targeted people and their leaders. That's what they did with the Serbs, and that's what they're doing with the Iraqis and Saddam Hussein. Let's go back to 1990-91 under George I. You remember there was a terrible war against Iraq. Over 100,000 people were killed. I was in Iraq 2 years ago, and I could still see the victims of that war. There are children who are born horribly weakened and malstructured because of the depleted uranium, especially down in the Basra region. And we visited these hospitals. Let me tell you, it was a wrenching thing to see this, to see my tax dollars at work here. But let's go back to 1991 under George I. We were told we had to bomb and kill people in Iraq first because Iraq was threatening Saudi Arabia. That was the first reason that was given. In fact, evidence was shown that there was absolutely no indication that Iraqi troops were massing on the Saudi border. And if they were going to invade Saudi Arabia, why didn't they just do it instead of waiting 4 months until the U.S. came in? It was a false charge. We also heard that Iraq was committing atrocities. The worst of these were the 500 Kuwaiti premature babies who were torn from incubators and thrown on the hospital floors by Iraqi soldiers who had devilish laughs and were laughing gleefully as they threw these babies to their deaths. And you know, some of us did some arithmetic. We said 500 incubators? All of Los Angeles County has only 40. And here in Kuwait, does Kuwait specialize in premature babies? later on it turned out that this story was a total fabrication. A couple of years later it came out, a total fabrication, as you know. That's public record. We were told that Iraq refused to negotiate. This too was false. Iraq was eager and anxious to negotiate, and in fact had entered into negotiations with a French delegation. They were hoping for a withdrawal. That withdrawal was called in the Bush administration the nightmare scenario. The worst thing, the last thing they wanted was for Iraq to withdraw. They would lose their reason for a casus belli. They would lose their reason to launch their attack of Iraq. The Iraqis asked only for 2 weeks to withdraw. Bush said, we'll give you 1 week, and in 1 week, and then he began to attack. and killing tens of thousands of people who were fleeing in the desert too, who weren't fighting, just leaving. We were also told that we had to bomb and destroy Iraq because they had committed aggression. They had invaded Kuwait. That was true. They had invaded Kuwait. But here, too, I wondered, at least. I said, but Turkey invaded Cyprus. We didn't bomb Turkey. Nice right-wing client state. Syria and Israel invaded Lebanon and was still occupying Lebanon. We didn't bomb Syria and Israel. Morocco invaded Western Sahara, but we didn't bomb Morocco. In fact, Turkey, Israel, Syria, Morocco, they were all getting aid, military aid from the U.S. Iraq itself had invaded Iran. We didn't bomb them then. We gave them aid. We gave them chemical and bacteriological factories to build up, to use against Iran. That's one of the best-kept stories around. There was another reason given, by the way, why we were going into bombing Iraq back in 1990, and that was because the war would create jobs. Now, I'm not making that one up. That was said by Secretary of State James Baker. I got that in one of my books somewhere. Now, I thought, this is the first time in 3 years that it's been in office that the Bush administration, George I, has shown any interest in creating jobs for Americans. This is amazing. Oh, what's amazing how virtue is developed here suddenly. Create jobs, bombing Iraq to create jobs. You know, auto accidents create jobs. They do. They really do. Auto accidents are good for the economy. I'm really serious. You have wreckers, you have tow trucks, you have hospitals, emergency clinics, rehabilitation, health workers, you have lawyers, you have all sorts of things. Auto accidents are good for the economy, and I'm serious. I'm not saying that in any kind of irony. They really do good things for the economy. They create jobs. What I am saying is that what's good for the capitalist economy is not always good for the people in the society. And that's been a central theme of this talk. Then, in late November or so of 1990, the Bush administration, George I, stumbled upon another reason for invading Iraq. You know, when somebody keeps coming up with reasons for why they did something or want to do something, you can be sure they're lying. You know, when you ask someone, you say, why did you do that? You say, well, I did, and then they come an hour later, well, you know, and also, and then they come back with a third reason. You know, you say, you're lying. Because if you had the right reason, if you knew what you did and you weren't ashamed of it and you weren't trying to cover it up, you would just say what it was. But you keep making and slapping on reasons. You're looking for reasons to justify this war. Because you can't tell them the real reason. Because the real reason has to do with power and global investment and capitalism and oil markets and oil prices and oil profits. You can't tell them that. You can't say go out and die for Exxon. You can't say go out and die for global investments. Go out and die for U.S. superpower global investment capitalism. You say go out and die for the poor Kuwaiti babies. Go out and die for this. So in the end of November, there was a poll taken. And the poll said, it was an opinion poll that said, would you support military action against Iraq if it posed a nuclear threat? And suddenly, American opinion, which had been rather lukewarm about committing U.S. forces to Iraq, suddenly the poll got something like a 65-70% response. And that became the theme, that Iraq had a nuclear capacity. Yes, yes, that's it. Yes, that's why we're going in to invade Iraq. And that to today, I find that very interesting. I found it very interesting back in 1990, and I find it very interesting today that that same reason is being conjured up right now, which is Iraq may have the capacity, the potential to develop weapons of mass destruction. You see? And that becomes the reason. The potential for such, and Iraq refuses to comply with inspection. That's a lie. In 1998, Teams of UN inspectors from a number, scores of countries went into Iraq, went all over the country. And the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Saeed al-Sharaf, wrote a statement at the time where he said, "What noncompliance?" And I want to read what he said, okay? He said they operated 427 inspections to 427 sites. 299 of these sites are included in the ongoing monitoring regime. 128 sites were not even included in the original agenda. But they still they asked to inspect them, and we accepted and cooperated. This is what else he says. They found total compliance in all 427 except for five cases. Five out of 427. One of them, they wanted to inspect a small headquarter of the political party, the Arab Socialist Party. We asked them, what is the relation between small headquarter of a political party and a disarmament mission? They did not answer, but the questions we raised was enough for them to charge that as a case of noncompliance. The second case, they came to inspect a small building which previously was the office of the deputy of the Director General of the Special Security Organization. This had been changed to a guest house. We pointed this out to them. While explaining it to them, and it took about 20 minutes or around 30 minutes, they put it in the report that this was one of the violations. "You have delayed us about 45 minutes, so you deserve to be bombarded, because you have delayed an inspection team for 45 minutes," only to explain to them that this was a guest house and no longer an office. After that, they did inspect it, yet they cited this as the second violation. The third violation was a number of establishments they wanted to visit on Friday, and we said everything is closed on Friday. If there's anything that's open on Friday, then we would be happy to let you inspect it, but you can do it some other time. That was listed as a non-compliance. Another case of inspection was a chief inspector, an American woman named Diana Simon. She went to Baghdad University, and she demanded to interview all the undergraduate students in the science college at Baghdad University. The Iraqi counterpart told her that this was incredible. What's the purpose of interviewing undergraduates and all of them? What was the relationship between Iraqi undergraduate students and disarmament? Usually UN inspection teams asked to interview some of the postgraduates for the master's degree, for the doctorate degree in science. You get the gist of it. You can get the gist of what the noncompliance and the demonic violation, this gangster outlaw government that can't abide by the rules of the UN. This is the kind of propaganda and pap that is being dished out to us. And if no weapons of mass destruction are found, then there's still the fact that there's no democracy in Iraq. Well, whose fault is that? Who put Saddam Hussein in power? This is another fact, isn't this? This is another fact that has been dropped down the memory hole of history. Saddam Hussein was CIA. Saddam Hussein was put into power by the CIA. His function was to stop the democratic Iraqi revolution. And that's what he did. He murdered democratic forces. He even exterminated the left wing of his own Ba'athist party. But he got out of line on oil prices. He got out of line on economic self-development. He got out of line by giving something to the people, the higher standard of living in the Middle East it used to have before the war of 1991. So they keep setting compliance standards higher. Oh, you don't have weapons? Well, you're not democratic. Oh, you're going to have elections? Yeah. Remember, this happened with Nicaragua. Oh, but these elections aren't fair. Elections are never fair in a country that's under the U.S. gun. Are never fair. This happened in Yugoslavia also. Never fair until the side we want wins. When that side wins, then the elections are called fair. In July of 2002, the prestigious Council for Foreign Relations reported that many people throughout the world saw the United States as, quote, arrogant, hypocritical, and self-absorbed. unquote. Self-absorbed, I'll say. You know, I remember this last September 11th, I had to watch some of it because I got to do these radio things, you know, and I'm supposed to be a media expert, so I got to watch this stuff because they ask me questions about it. So if you want to see a kid, pained kid doing his homework, I'm sitting there watching Barbara Walters, Barbara Wawa, and she's got 6 9/11 widows, these women who are widows, and she's asking them, "Do you miss your husband?" "When you think of your husband, do you feel pleasure or pain?" So Jesus Christ, what a question! When you think of your husbands, you feel pleasure or pain? Can you cry on camera, please? No, she didn't say that, but she goes over to a little kid. The little girl couldn't have been more than 4 years old, and she says, "What do you remember most about your daddy? What do you miss?" And that's when I grabbed the remote control and I flicked her out of oblivion. It was that or break my own television set, which wouldn't be a bad idea, but I'm a media expert, so I gotta. Okay, arrogant, hypocritical, and self-absorbed. A world survey. They did the survey in Africa, Asia, Latin America, all around the world, and they didn't find people saying, "Oh, America, oh, I love it, this is a beautiful country." Remember J. Carroll Nash? When I was a kid, J. Carroll Nash used to play in these movies. He used to play a character named Luigi, you know, an Irishman playing a Luigi. I'm not going to say anything about that. Okay, and he got up and said, "Oh, I'm a lover. This a country, America." There's no Italian had an accent like that. This a beautiful country I love. And we still got those. We still have immigrants coming from very terrible, unfortunate situations. And yeah, when they get here, it is better for them. Indeed, it is. That's why people come to have a better and more decent life here. This is a whole room full of immigrants or descendants of immigrants. But it's a funny thing. They didn't get those answers when they did this survey. People said arrogant, hypocritical, self-absorbed. U.S. global power was less admired than it was feared and hated. U.S. policies abroad were experienced. They were not seen as the offerings of a democratic republic. They were seen as the bitter fruits of a repressive empire. And this was shocking. Now, you would think that The Council for Foreign Relations, which after all is a semi-official policy-making group, every Secretary of State, every Secretary of Defense, every CIA director, every leading members of the Senate, corporate heads, also they're all in the Council for Foreign Relations. Some leading publicists are in it. It's one of the most influential policy-making units, a voice for corporate America and a voice for policy America, if there was such a thing. It'd be too much then to expect that, given this status where they are, that they would call for a critical reappraisal of U.S. policy. They would call for drastic changes in goals and interests. You think they would say, "We've got to rethink what we're doing here, you know? We've got to see what is it we're doing wrong?" No. They already knew what we were doing wrong. And they said, we're not selling ourselves well. We've got to do a better job of selling ourselves. They reduced it to a public relations problem. If people don't like us, well, it can't be that there's anything wrong with us. There's something wrong with their perceptions. Or there's something wrong with the image that we're projecting. So we've got to change that image, and then they'll like us. If Bush can pull off the war, this next massacre and slaughter of Iraq, then he will try it against Iran, and he will try it against Cuba. He's already sending out sounds about Cuba. And if they can't eventually get Venezuela destabilized in the usual way with disruptions and breakdowns in the economy and starving them out and killing the leader, if they can't do that, and if it becomes necessary for wholesale intervention, then there'll be more direct intervention against Venezuela. And if they can't stop the Colombian wars of national liberation, then there'll be direct, and there is direct intervention. You U.S. troops are in Colombia, the Philippines, Kosovo, Macedonia, Bosnia, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Afghanistan, and I know I've left out places, 300 military bases all over the world. But there does remain the problem of weak support all over the world, weak support at home and abroad, some limited tactical dissent, even in the Republican Party. I mean, don't place too much hope on that, you know. But this is the foreign policy of a plutocratic batterer. It's a batterer nation that batters and batters and batters repeatedly. But there also happens to be strong opposition, very strong opposition throughout the Middle East, Europe, especially in Greece, now in Germany, in France, Italy. A friend of mine from Perugia told me 1 million people marched from Perugia to Assisi some months back. 1 million people. He's Italian, he does exaggerate a little bit, but it was a huge, demonstration. The Saudi leadership themselves have turned and said they're worried. We will not support a war against Iraq. They're worried about the public reaction in their country. Now, when would they ever worried about public reaction in their country, I'm saying? But they are. I mean, it's very strong. They're also worried, I think, about something else. They're worried about an absolute power being placed over their absolute power. They're worried that this superpower is really dictating everything everywhere, that there's no input from them. Well, I'm going to stop right here. Let me just tell you something. I'll go back to ancient Rome again, where it all began, I've decided. I'm going to argue that at least while my book is out for a while. In ancient Rome, there were some notables, I think it was during the late Republic, who got the idea that slaves should have a visible insignia, or maybe a uniform, a yellow tunic or something, so that they could be visibly identifiable. Because the problem was, we didn't know who were slaves and who were just poor plebs and who were poor proletariat, Roman proletariat. And they mixed in, and often slaves showed up in odd places, even having an input in the forum, yelling or whatever else. And now we've got to put them in their place and make them visible. Put the mark on them. Keep them in their place. So, and keep them separate then from the other poor. Sometimes work forces would have some free labor and slave labor working together. And there was a lot of collaboration between the two. Then they had second thoughts about that. They said, you know, if we give them these visible insignias, it will not only increase their visibility to us, but it'll increase their visibility to each other. And they'll begin to see how numerous they are. And they'll begin to get a sense of their ubiquity and their strength. And it would be too dangerous. So the idea was dropped. Well, we as citizens, of whom they would make slaves, we need to see who we are, our strength and our numbers, our critical independence of mind and action. And that's what they fear the most, our critical independence of mind and action. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I think I'm going to answer a few questions, if I may. It's getting on, and my voice is starting to give way. But we could take a few, just a few questions, yeah, or comments. Yes, miss?
Do you have any figures on the amount of money that the Bush administration has spent on the war on terrorism?
The question is, do I have any figures on the amount of money that the Bush administration has spent on the war on terrorism? Well, depending on how the war is defined, if you mean pending against Iraq, well, then it's that whole escalation of the military budget. If you mean just homeland security, that would be, it's billions. It's actually, it's oodles and oodles and oodles of it. But if anyone here does have any hard figures for all the specific slots of the war on terrorism, come forward. But I don't offhand right now. Yeah. Just gentlemen. Yeah, and then you. Okay. Yeah.
Rome, in some ways, just fell from being like the most powerful country or whatever. And I think England, at one point, fell. How do you think this country's going to go down? Do you think it's going to divide it and no longer be imperial?
The question is, the Roman Empire fell and the British Empire fell, and how do you think this global superpower is going to go down? There is such a thing as excessive success, and you can be so successful in devouring. One thing Augustus did with the Senate, for instance, and this is why they never moved against him. They moved against Caesar. They moved against the Gracchi. They moved against Clodius. They moved against a number of people. They never moved against Augustus or any of the emperors who came afterwards, because they never tried to make any popular changes. But one thing he did do, he would sometimes rein in some of these senators. And it's the case of what I was saying before, where the state actually suppresses certain of its own particular economic interests because of a larger systemic interest in keeping that thing going. In other words, you restrain the parasites who, if you let them go and batten and gorge themselves, will destroy the very organism on which they are feeding. And that is always the tendency and the danger. You can see that happening today in Argentina, where the capitalist state is literally has been unable to restrain and control the capitalist, financial, investor, swindling, pirate, mafia class that has robbed the Argentinian people of their life savings. I mean, middle-class people who had, you know, I know a friend of mine, Argentinian, she had $10,000 in the bank. You know, she is a woman in her early 60s. $10,000, that was just like that cushion. It's gone. It's just gone. Now, that stuff isn't just gone. There are people who walked off with that. I mean, so you got a point where the state literally no longer restrains that accumulation momentum in class. And that class then left unregulated free market piracy, it destroys its own base. It literally just destroys the society. And you've got new things developing in Argentina, like people creating now their own script money and starting to work at a communal economy and doing local services and doing this for food and that and so forth. And those things are building up. And if those become successful, of course, the corporations will move right back in with Starbucks and McDonald's and the like. But you keep fighting, and it's a hopeful thing in the face of all of that. I don't know how the superpower. I think the case is not analogous to Rome or the British Empire, because this time the ecological base is itself being consumed by this system, and there may not be another 100 years to see how this will go. But if you leave it up to Bush, he may let it happen a hell of a lot quicker. Yeah.
There seems to be growing momentum for corporations taking interest in principles of sustainability, or answering to a triple bottom line of the economy and the social and the environmental movement as well. Do you see something real there? Does it give you any hope, or do you see that it's just some sort of greenwashing?
He said corporations have been moving now. Some of them have been talking about sustainability and this sort of thing. Is that just greenwashing, or do you think there's some real hope there? Well, I think it's interesting, and I'm positive about it in terms of how symptomatic. It's symptomatic of the fact that they are suddenly forced or compelled to be cognizant of it, even if it only is appearance manipulation. They've been doing greenwashing, by the way, for years and years and years, talking about, oh, we work for the environment, and then you look closer, corporation A, B, or C, and they haven't done a damn thing at all, except put out PR relation things with a little picture of a clear lake, you know, and that sort of a thing. But there are moves in the private sector, too. There are moves in the state of California, where I'm living. We just passed some laws about greater support for wind and solar energy. I mean, so that's making a resurgence and coming forward. And the law has been passed and signed by that sellout hypocrite conservative Gray Davis, who is the Democratic governor of California. It's hard to tell them apart sometimes, you know. Sometimes, most of the time, all the time. Well, most of the time, there are a few good ones. Yes, miss. Yes, yes, we want to alternate gender. We've had two men and one woman. I'm keeping count. We got to have another woman. I'm not quite sure I understand the question. I don't know. What are you thinking? What do you have in mind as bypassing it? I'm not sure. Well, there are, it is true, when I say substantive democracy, I don't mean consumerism. Consumerism, I really do mean much more, I mean the social wage. I mean rational, clean, non-polluting methods of mass transportation. I mean agricultural bases that are not overly centralized and always 1,000 miles away, so the food has to be shipped 1,000 miles before you can eat it. I mean health care and all these kinds of things. The other consumer stuff, you know, even the people who were bought into that stuff, some of them, I was in Walmarts once. This was a nation of wall-to-wall marts, right? And I remember this woman, she said, come on, we don't need that junk. I remember her saying she had some junk in her carriage there and already, but even the ones who were buying it kind of know this is just junk and I mean, some things you need, you know, there are people who speak mightily against any kind of material consumption, you know. They got their home and listen to their hi-fi and their CDs or whatever. So I don't know. Most definitely, what we need is less private glut of the commodity market and more social wage, public needs is what I was talking about. Those public needs are almost always, and this might answer your question, those public needs are almost always put on the agenda, articulated, and pushed by ordinary people, not by elites or politicians or corporate leaders or notable leading personalities in society or cultural figures or whatever. Those things are the needs for health care, that's been put out by ordinary people. The need for a sustainable environment, it's not the EPA, it's no president that did that. That was ordinary people who have been fighting and arguing for those things. The development of the whole trade union movement, there's no elites, there are no social, they all oppose those things. That was ordinary working people themselves doing that. So we must not, you know, we must not underestimate our fellow citizens. For all their shortcomings, for all their insufficiencies, for all the problems they have, you know, many people are too busy trying to make a living to make history. They can't make history. But for all their deficiencies, whatever else, the people are our best hope. In fact, we are they. Thank you. Good night.